Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by Lang et al. Retrospective cohort study of emergency department to PICU transfers, emergency department factors associated with delirium development within 24 hours of hospitalization. Objectives. Many PICU admissions start with presentation in the emergency department, or ED. However, we do not know whether there are any ED-related factors associated with the subsequent development of pediatric delirium within 24 hours of PICU admission. Design. Retrospective cohort study. Setting. Single-center ED and PICU serving a quaternary referral center in the United States. Patients. Children younger than 18 years old presenting to the ED between January 2022 and December 2023 who required direct admission to the PICU and who had at least one positive delirium screening within 24 hours of the admission. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The presence of delirium in the PICU was defined as a Cornell Assessment of Pediatric Delirium, or a CAPD score of 9 and higher. We identified 138 patients for the final analysis. Overall, 51 of 138 patients, or 37%, developed pediatric delirium within 24 hours of admission. Delirium cases were classified as the following subtypes. A majority were hypoactive in 53%, or 27 of 51, followed by mixed, 31%, or 16 of 51, followed by hyperactive in 16%, or 8 of 51. Factors associated with greater odds of delirium in the PICU in multivariable analysis were use of mechanical ventilation, with an odds ratio of 3.42 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.09 to 10.78 and a p-value equal to 0.04, and intermittent urinary catheterization, with an odds ratio of 3.7, a 95% confidence interval of 1.21 to 11.3, and a p-value equal to 0.02. Initial CAPD score positively correlated with PICU length of stay with an R equal to 0.32 and a p-value less than 0.01, as well as pediatric index of mortality 3 or PIM3 score with an R equal to 0.26 and a p-value less than 0.01, and negatively correlated with emergency severity index or ESI in the ED with an R equal to negative 0.35 and a p-value less than 0.01. Conclusions. Mechanical ventilation and intermittent urinary catheterization in the ED are associated with greater odds of pediatric delirium within 24 hours of PICU admission. CAPD at admission positively correlates with PICU length of stay, PIM3 scores, and negatively correlates with ESI in the ED. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by Wedgwood et al. Timing of death in children referred for intensive care with sepsis, comparison of two cohorts in the United Kingdom, 2005 to 2011 versus 2018 to 2023. Objective: to review the timing of death in children with sepsis referred for intensive care from 2018 to 2023 and compare with our previous 2005 to 2011 practice. We hypothesize that most deaths occur within 24 hours of referral to the PICU, with many before PICU admission. Design, setting, and patients. We reviewed referrals to the Children's Acute Transport Service, or CATS, North Thames Regional Pediatric Intensive Care Transport Service in the United Kingdom between January 2018 and March 2023. We included referrals of children younger than 16 years old with a working diagnosis of sepsis, severe sepsis, septicemia, or septic shock. The primary outcome measure was time to death up to a year after referral. Measurements and main results. Over the 62-month study period, 11,231 referrals were made to CATS, and 330, or 3%, met the study inclusion criteria. Outcome data were available on 272, of whom 29, or 11%, died in the first year after referral, which compares favorably with our 2005 to 2011 cohort from the same service, in which the one-year mortality was 21%, or 130 of 627. The mean difference was 10%, with a 95% confidence interval of 4.8 to 14.6% and a p-value equal to 0.0003. 18 of the 29 deaths occurred in the first 24 hours after referral. Amongst children with comorbidities, 12 of 139, or 9%, died, compared to 6 of 133, or 5%, previously healthy children, with a p-value equal to 0.22 and an odds ratio of 2 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.73 to 5.5. By 1 year, mortality in children with comorbidities was 19 of 139, or 13.9%, versus mortality in previously healthy children of 10 of 133, or 7.5%, with a p-value equal to 0.12 and an odds ratio of 1.9 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.82 to 4.1. Conclusions. In 2018 to 2023, the proportion of referrals for PICU retrieval with a clinical diagnosis of sepsis was low at 3%. As with our 2005 to 2011 cohort, most deaths occurred within 24 hours of first referral. Therefore, early recognition and resuscitation still have the greatest potential for improving sepsis outcomes, which has implications for clinical trials. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Sabatka et al. 3-year follow-up of PICU survivors, time course of neurodevelopmental sequelae in a single-center cohort recruited from 2017 to 2018. Objectives: to use a multidimensional outcomes portfolio to assess neurodevelopmental sequelae among PICU survivors during the first 3 years after hospital discharge. Design: prospective study of a cohort recruited from 2017 to 2018 with interval follow-up for 3 years. Setting: PICU at an urban academic tertiary care center. Patients: children 0 to 17 years admitted to the PICU with anticipated discharge home. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We evaluated outcomes using a PICU Outcomes Portfolio, or POP, survey, which combined a study-specific healthcare and neurodevelopmental profile and the Family Impact Survey and standardized measurement tools, including the Pediatric Quality of Life Inventory, the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire, and the National Institute for Children's Health Quality Vanderbilt Assessment Scales, to identify various components of post-PICU challenges. Our POP survey identified a sustained impact of child health on family finances and parental employment. Our multidimensional outcomes assessment flagged more at-risk children than individual measures of neurodevelopmental functioning. Conclusions: children and families face diverse challenges during recovery from critical illness. Parent-reported outcomes and a multidimensional outcomes portfolio identify the broad impact of critical illness on family well-being, as well as the long-term outcomes among PICU survivors. Future mixed method studies incorporating parental input regarding post-discharge needs are needed to enrich the evaluation of post-PICU outcomes using standardized measures and guide the development of post-PICU follow-up programs. Abstract 4 is a featured original research article by Lowe et al. Platelet Count Trajectory and Survival in Children with Sepsis, Single Center Retrospective Study in China, from 2015 to 2023. Objectives: in children with sepsis, thrombocytopenia is linked to poor outcomes, including longer hospital length of stay, increased bleeding risk, and higher mortality. However, the clinical significance of changes in platelet counts over time remain poorly characterized. We have examined dynamic platelet patterns and their associations with mortality and patient illness factors. Design: single-center retrospective cohort study. Setting: hospital pediatrics and PICU at Guangdong Women and Children's Hospital, China. Patients: children with sepsis between January 2015 and December 2023. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Group-based trajectory analysis was used to examine the trend in platelet count during the first 7 days of hospital admission. A regression model was developed to investigate possible associations between patient characteristics with platelet count trajectory. Additionally, a multivariable Cox proportional hazards model adjusted for age, sex, comorbidities, and site and source of infection was constructed to evaluate the association between platelet count trajectories and 28-day mortality. Among 1,010 children with sepsis, we identified 3 platelet count trajectories with distinct characteristics: age, fibrinogen level, activated partial thromboplastin time, and lactic acid were each associated with platelet count trajectories. The overall 28-day mortality for the cohort was 5.4%, varying across groups: 1.2% in group 3 with persistently high platelet count, 2.2 in group 2 with high normal platelet count, and 12.6 in group 1 with low platelet count. In the multivariable Cox proportional hazards model compared with group 1, both groups 2 and 3 were independently associated with reduced hazard of death at 28 days, with a hazard ratio of 0.26 and p-value of less than 0.001 for group 2, and hazard ratio of 0.18 and p-value equal to 0.021 for group 3. Conclusions: We have identified three distinct and clinically relevant platelet count trajectories in children with sepsis, which serve as robust associations with survival in this patient population. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation article by Prokopiak et al. Severe neonatal respiratory failure and transfer for higher level intensive care. Early factors associated with mortality and other outcomes in a retrospective cohort from 2018 to 2020. Objectives: to identify factors associated with death, requirement for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO, or cardiac intervention in neonates referred for a higher level neonatal ICU or NICU due to respiratory failure. Design: retrospective cohort study from 2018 to 2020. Setting: referrals for transport to tertiary level NICUs using the London Neonatal Transfer Service in the United Kingdom. Patients: neonates with a diagnosis of severe respiratory failure who were intubated and receiving FiO2 greater than 60% at referral. We excluded neonates younger than 34 weeks corrected gestational age, less than 2 kilograms, or with a known cardiac diagnosis. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We identified 170 neonates with a median age of 4 hours and an interquartile range of 2 to 11 hours at referral, and 9 hours with an interquartile range of 7 to 16 hours at time of departure from the referring NICU. Overall, 21 of 170 babies required immediate transfer to a center providing ECMO, of whom 2 of 21 died and 2 of 21 received ECMO support. Of the 149 transferred to NICUs that do not provide ECMO, 11 of 149 died, or 7%, and a further 16 of 149, or 11%, required secondary transfers to an ECMO center, where 1 of 16 died and 3 of 16 required ECMO. In total, there were 23 of 170 neonates with outcome of death, need for ECMO, or cardiac intervention. A composite score of vasoactive inotropic score, or VIS, greater than or equal to 18, and oxygenation index, or OI, greater than 24 after patient stabilization was associated with death, need for ECMO, or a previously undiagnosed cardiac lesion, with a sensitivity of 83% and a specificity of 73%. Conclusions: this 2018 to 2020 cohort of neonates with severe respiratory failure managed in London, United Kingdom, shows that VIS greater than or equal to 18 and OI greater than 24 after stabilization were associated with death, need for ECMO, or cardiac intervention. These parameters may have the potential to trigger discussion with ECMO centers for early consideration of transfer, but needs validation in a wider neonatal population. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation article by Janis et al. Burden of intracranial hypertension and patterns of brain injury on MRI. Secondary analysis of the 2014 to 2017 approaches and decisions for acute pediatric TBI study. Objectives: elevated intracranial pressure, or ICP, is a complication of severe traumatic brain injury, or TBI, that carries a risk of secondary brain injury. This study investigated the association between ICP burden and brain injury patterns on MRI in children with severe TBI. Design, setting, and patients. Secondary analysis of the approaches and decisions in acute pediatric TBI or ADAPT study, which included children with severe TBI defined as Glasgow Coma Scale score less than 9 who received a clinical MRI within 30 days of injury. We excluded patients who had ICP monitoring less than 24 hours, were missing ICP data for greater than 40% of monitoring time, or who underwent craniectomy. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. ICP burden was defined as the trapezoidal area under the curve of hourly ICP greater than 20 millimeters of mercury. ICP was standardized to total monitoring time, and patients were categorized to 4 levels of ICP burden. MRI was evaluated for number of diffuse axonal injury, or DAI, microhemorrhages, intracerebral hemorrhage, or ICH, volume, contusion volume, and number of regions with ischemia. Fisher exact or chi-square tests were used to test the independence between ICP burden and MRI injury amount. Of the 220 patients, 156, or 71%, had DAI, 31, or 14%, had ICH, 161, or 73%, had contusions, and 70, or 32%, had ischemia on MRI. Most patients, 180 or 82%, experienced episodes of ICP greater than 20 millimeters of mercury. Contusion volume had a p-value equal to 0.02, and number of regions with ischemia had a p-value equal to 0.007, and both were associated with ICP burden, but we failed to identify such an association for DAI or ICH. Severe, but not mild or moderate, ICP burden was associated with presence of ischemia, with an odds ratio of 4.64, a 95% confidence interval of 1.3 to 19.5, and a p-value equal to 0.02. Conclusions. Elevated ICP was prevalent in the ADAPT cohort. Ischemia and contusion were associated with the burden of ICP. Further research is needed to determine temporal relationships between elevated ICP and ischemia. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation article by Takuda et al. Urine output trajectories and dialysis independence in critically ill children with acute kidney injury, a single-center retrospective cohort study from 2014 to 2023. Objectives: to investigate whether the urine output trajectory is associated with dialysis independence in critically ill children with acute kidney injury, or AKI. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: a PICU in Japan. Patients: children younger than 16 years old who received continuous kidney replacement therapy, or CKRT, for AKI between July 1, 2014 and June 30, 2023. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We identified 61 eligible patients, including 16 patients who remained dialysis dependent 30 days after CKRT initiation. Compared with dialysis-independent patients, dialysis dependence was associated with lower urine output on days 3, 7, 14, and 21 after CKRT initiation. Dialysis independence, when compared with dialysis dependence, was associated with higher median urine output measured in milliliters per kilogram per hour at each time point. Day 3, 0.3 milliliters per kilogram per hour with an interquartile range of 0.1 to 1.6 versus 0 with an interquartile range of 0 to 0.2 and a p-value equal to 0.001. Day 7, 1.3 milliliters per kilogram per hour with an interquartile range of 0.4 to 2 versus 0 with an interquartile range of 0 to 0.1 and a p-value less than 0.001. Day 14, 1.8 milliliters per kilogram per hour with an interquartile range of 1 to 3.5 versus 0 with an interquartile range of 0 to 0 and a p-value less than 0.001. And day 21 was 2.1 milliliters per kilogram per hour with an interquartile range of 1.1 to 3 versus 0 with an interquartile range of 0 and a p-value less than 0.001. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve for identifying dialysis independence at day 30 after CKRT initiation, based on urine output on day 14, was 0.96 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.88 to 1. Using the DeLong test, this area under the receiver operating characteristic curve was higher than that on day 7, 0.88 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.77 to 0.99 and a p-value equal to 0.009. Also, on day 14 with a pre-test probability of dialysis independence of 71%, the post-test probability increases to 97% when using a test urine output greater than or equal to 0.41 milliliters per kilogram per hour. The sensitivity analysis with the exclusion of neonates yielded similar results. Conclusions. In this 2014 to 2023 cohort of critically ill children with AKI supported with CKRT, using a urine output greater than or equal to 0.41 milliliters per kilogram per hour on day 14, CKRT may be an effective diagnostic test of dialysis independence on day 30. Further validation studies are needed. Abstract 8 is a clinical investigation article by Perez et al. Postoperative mechanical ventilation for children with medical complexity undergoing spinal fusion. A Pediatric Health Information System Database, 2016 to 2021 cohort. Objectives: to assess the prevalence and factors associated with duration of postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation, or IMV, in children with medical complexity undergoing spinal fusion. Design: retrospective cohort study of the Pediatric Health Information System Database. Setting: 47 tertiary referral U.S. children's hospitals. Patients: Patients 5 to 18 years old with an underlying neuromuscular or genetic disorder admitted to the ICU following thoracic lumbar spinal fusion for scoliosis, with hospital discharge between January 1, 2016 and December 31, 2021. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. There were 6,511 patients who met inclusion criteria, of which 438, or 6.7%, had established preoperative tracheostomy and ventilator dependence. 372, or 5.7%, and 458, or 7%, patients underwent postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation for 4 to 6 days and greater than or equal to 7 days, respectively. Chronic conditions associated with greater odds of greater than or equal to 4 days of postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation, as shown by adjusted odds ratio, included diseases affecting the following systems. Neurologic, with an adjusted odds ratio of 3.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.5 to 5. Respiratory, with an adjusted odds ratio of 2.8 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.3 to 3.5. Skin or subcutaneous tissue, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.2 to 2.1. Hematologic, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.4 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.7. Endocrine or metabolic, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.3 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.6. Genitourinary, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.3 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.7. And cardiac, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.3 and a 95% confidence interval of 1 to 1.7. Established preoperative tracheostomy was associated with lower odds of greater than or equal to 4 days of postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.1 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.02 to 0.3. New tracheostomy procedures were uncommon, with an N equal to 43 or 0.7%. Finally, there was substantial regional variation in postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation after spinal fusion, with patients in the Northeast versus Midwest region having greater odds of greater than or equal to 4 days of postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation, with an adjusted odds ratio of 3.1 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.9 to 5. Conclusions. 1 in 8 children required greater than or equal to 4 days of invasive mechanical ventilation after spinal fusion. Chronic conditions affecting the neurologic, respiratory, skin or subcutaneous tissue, hematologic, endocrine or metabolic, genitourinary, and cardiac systems were associated with postoperative invasive mechanical ventilation. Further understanding of chronic conditions, clinical characteristics, and regional factors associated with duration of invasive mechanical ventilation may identify opportunities for improvement in care delivery. Abstract 9 is the PCCM Conference Report and Expert Panel by Becker et al. Neurocritical Care and Trustable Professional Activities for Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Education and Professional Development, Standardizing Curriculum, Training, and Assessment. Objective: to develop a set of pediatric neurocritical care, or PNCC, and Trustable Professional Activities, or EPAs, for Pediatric Critical Care Medicine, or PCCM. Design: survey and Delphi methodology in a panel of experts from the Pediatric Neurocritical Care Research Group, or PNCRG, and the Education in Pediatric Intensive Care, or EPIC, Research Collaborative. Setting: interprofessional local focus group, national focus group, and subsequent national, multi-institutional, multidisciplinary expert panel in the United States. Subjects: the interprofessional local group of 23 members carried out work from March 2022 to June 2022, and the national group of 19 members from October 2022 to November 2022. Subsequently, 38 physicians from the PNCRG and EPIC networks carried out work from December 2022 to August 2024. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. First, a preliminary set of 15 PNCC EPAs was developed by two local and national interprofessional groups. The EPAs were based on the American Board of Pediatrics Practice Analysis for Pediatric Critical Care Medicine, the American Board of Pediatrics Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Content Outline, and Stakeholder Opinion. Next, a panel of critical care, neurology, and education experts used Delphi methodology to generate consensus, edit, and finalize the EPAs with content validity. All EPAs were edited. Two were deemed non-essential and not included in the final set of 13 EPAs. the EPAs fit three categories: general management and principles, disease-specific management, and neuroprognostication and end-of-life care. Consensus was reached after three Delphi rounds with response rates of 31 of 38, 29 of 31, and 29 of 31, respectively. The final set of EPAs was approved by 30 respondents with a response rate of 30 of 31 with content validity indices 0.81 to 1. Conclusions. The 2024 set of 13 EPAs are intended to be a valuable framework for competency-based curriculum and assessment to ensure consistent pediatric critical care medicine proficiency in the provision of neurocritical care, while also promoting standardization and curriculum development for pediatric critical care medicine fellowship trainees. The PCCM narrative this month is entitled "The Quiet Revolution Under My Vest" by Dr. Jenna Esikow. The rhythmic beep of ICU monitors created the perfect cover, or so I hoped. Tucked into a noisy corner of the PICU, I stood on rounds with my portable breast pumps vibrating with a muffled mechanical hum beneath my vest. The sound, amplified by my self-consciousness, was drowned out by the cacophony of monitor alarms and overhead announcements. I silently prayed no one noticed the tubing hidden in my pockets or my oversized vest zipped high, feeling exposed not just by the sound and bulk of the pumps, but by the intimacy of performing something so personal in a public, high-stakes space. After my son's birth, I returned to my second home, the PICU, a place that hadn't changed even though I had. I was the same physician in the same space, yet I was learning to navigate this familiar environment through a new lens. Beneath my vest, the hum of my breast pump served as a physical reminder of the dual responsibilities I now carried. The subtle weight pressed against me throughout the day, mirroring the emotional and mental load of early motherhood. Despite the relentless pace of the unit, I remained committed to breastfeeding while continuing to lead a multidisciplinary team in the care of critically ill children. As I navigated the logistics of pumping between patient care and leadership responsibilities, I learned that over the course of a year, lactation can demand as much as 1,800 hours. That's the equivalent of another 40-hour work week layered onto an already exhausting schedule. And yet, the expectations are clear. Both the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months of life. Meeting these goals in medicine, particularly in critical care, often feels like an impossible ask. In the PICU, stepping away to pump is often incompatible with the nature of our work: rounding, responding to emergencies, running codes, and bearing the emotional weight of family conversations. Ideally, we would have protected time and space, but in critical care, time is rarely your own. Still, we adapt, balancing the chaos of the ICU with the commitment of motherhood. After experimenting with four different portable pumps, spending more than I'd like to admit on them, and testing every scrub top for discretion, I finally committed to going live, pumping while simultaneously working, and I wasn't alone. As I opened up to colleagues, a quiet solidarity emerged. One had intubated a crashing patient with pumps beneath her gown. Another paused just long enough to remove her pumps before running a code. In the high-stakes world of critical care, women physicians are managing life and death moments while simultaneously meeting the needs of their own infants. Each one of their stories reflect not only individual resilience, but also the shared reality of balancing two essential roles: caregiver at work and caregiver at home. What struck me wasn't just how common it was, but how quietly we all carried it. That's starting to change. The silence is beginning to lift. The rotating resident consolidates milk at her workstation without skipping a beat. An attending signs out with her pump vibrating the table. A nurse calmly administers sedation medication while her portable pump pulsated in sync with the IV pump. These moments, unremarkable to some, represent something transformative, a quiet revolution. For pediatric intensivists, wearable pumps are more than convenience, they are tools of equity. They enable us to meet professional and personal responsibilities in parallel. Supporting lactation is not a lifestyle preference, it is a workforce issue. It affects burnout, retention, and the sustainability of our providers. It's about not forcing women to choose between caring for their patients and caring for their own children. Hospital systems need to continue to support this change by promoting lactation-friendly practices. What does this look like? Clean, accessible lactation rooms in every unit, allowing scheduling flexibility without fear of repercussions, investing in wearable pumps for medical trainees, and recognizing that these accommodations aren't special treatment but are baseline measures to retain and support a diverse, capable workforce. Women in medicine already face steep challenges. They experience pay gaps, underrepresentation in leadership, higher infertility rates, and disproportionate caregiving responsibilities. Many cut back hours or leave altogether. The cumulative effect results in the medical field losing talented providers because the system isn't built with them in mind. But culture can change, step by step, vest by vest, pump by pump. And yet, amid all these systemic barriers, there are quiet moments of connection that remind us why this work and push for change matter. One morning during rounds, I noticed the faint buzz of another pump in the room. It wasn't from a colleague, but from a patient's mother standing at the door participating in rounds. We exchanged a knowing smile, quietly sharing the same hum. In that moment, we weren't just doctor and parent, we were two mothers bonded by the same rhythm of caregiving. We are setting a new norm. We are reshaping our field with quiet, purposeful acts of visibility and support. Pumping while working isn't something to hide, but something we make space for, something we talk about, something we support, openly, actively, unapologetically. We're not just showing up for our patients, we're showing up for each other and for the next generation of women in medicine. Caregiving is not a liability in critical care. It's one of our greatest strengths. This concludes the abstracts for the November 2025 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.